Edition, Second Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, Tape Number 11, Session Number 6.
And welcome to the last session, which is devoted to issues concerning evaluation and treatment. Just a couple of announcements before we get started. Wanted to repeat the departures for transportation to Atlanta. For people catching flights from 12 to 1, there will be a departure at 10 a.m. Flights 1:30 to 2:30, a bus or some sort of van from here leaving at 11. For flights that are between 3 and 4 this afternoon, a van or bus departure here at 12:30, and for all others, a departure here at 1. The presentation this morning is by Dr. Peter Gao, who comes to us from New Zealand, and he will talk on the investigation of neuromuscular function in post-polio patients, a practical approach. Peter.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to begin by thanking Laura and the organizing committee for inviting me to present the data from the department of Professor Richard Edwards, who would have liked to have been here himself had he not had a prior commitment. However, I'm delighted to be the fortunate recipient of your excellent hospitality, and the information which I've gained from the excellent presentations over the past few days will be of significant benefit to polio survivors in New Zealand. I think at the outset I'm obliged to point out that the units of Professor Edwards and myself have very limited experience of the investigation and management of patients with the post-polio syndrome. However, we are both involved in investigating the muscular performance of many patients who present with other profound fatiguing illnesses, including the post-viral syndrome. These are collectively known as effort syndromes and have similar symptoms to those of patients with the post-polio syndrome. With fatigue, muscular pain, and breathing difficulties being prominent amongst them. Many post-polio patients must feel like those represented in the following cartoon. However, there are a number of rational explanations for the loss of performance in polio survivors, including those outlined on the next slide. The role of the clinicians and physiologists is to determine the relative contribution of each of these factors and to plan a management program which encompasses them all, including the anxiety which results from the unpleasant and disabling symptoms of ill-defined origin. A detailed clinical history is necessary to establish the patient's physical status before contracting polio, and also to determine the extent of residual weakness when the acute infection subsided. Clinical examination is aimed at determining whether the present symptoms might be related to a pathology other than previous poliomyelitis. The extent of the previous disease can be estimated by routine EMG and needle muscle biopsy. In addition to showing the presence of muscle fiber type grouping in previously affected muscle, the biopsy reveals the proportion of type 1 fibers, which are related to muscle endurance, and type 2 fibers related to muscle strength, but more easily fatigued. I would caution, however, against over-interpreting biopsy changes because many of our patients with ill-defined myalgia have non-specific findings, including muscle cell breakdown and lymphocyte infiltration. Functional limitations related to the disability mean that greater effort or energy expenditure may be required for activities such as daily living. For example, abnormalities of walking can be examined by formal gait analysis in conjunction with the measurement of aerobic capacity and then used to assess the suitability and effect of orthoses to improve the metabolic cost of walking. Provided there is no serious asymmetry of muscle strength in the lower limbs or lower joint deformity which would interfere with cycling action, cycloergometry is a useful means for assessing cardiorespiratory fitness. Measurement of perception of effort and heart rate during cycloergometry, together with blood lactate estimation, examines the appropriateness of physiological and psychological responses to graded exercise under controlled conditions. This also allows the work rate to be determined and has the advantage of showing the patient that it is safe to exercise and therefore building confidence in a therapeutic exercise program. Because manual clinical tests are imprecise, physiological measurements are necessary for identifying the factors contributing to fatigue and weakness. I'll now describe techniques performed in Liverpool by my co-worker Dr. Maria Stokes for assessing motor performance, which may be affected at any point in the chain of command for voluntary contraction. The assessment of muscle weakness can be determined with either Cybex equipment or strain gauge dynamometry. Weakness is defined as the failure to generate force or power output. Possible causes include loss and or atrophy of motor units, failure of motor unit recruitment, or abnormalities in units recruited. This is generated during isometric maximal voluntary contractions and can be measured accurately by strain gauge dynamometry. Quadriceps maximal voluntary contractions correlate well with body weight, but even more closely with quadriceps cross-sectional area, as measured by either ultrasound or CT scanning. An example of a CT scan in the mid-thigh is demonstrated in the next slide. Measurements of muscle fiber size and whole muscle cross-sectional area indicate whether weakness is due to loss or atrophy of fibers. Relating body weight to the force per unit fiber area allows estimation of expected forces generated and the possibility of fatigue or damage occurring during excessive forces. Weakness in the absence of pain, which is inappropriately low for the size of the muscle, may be due to lack of motivation or may indicate reflex inhibition. The latter may be due to joint damage associated with muscle weakness and joint instability. The contribution of reflex inhibition to the weakness of muscle contractions can be assessed by measuring muscle size and strength and voluntary and reflex activation by EMG and H-reflex testing. Pain can also be an inhibiting influence, and there is therefore a need to distinguish between fatigue and pain in the muscle, whether originating from muscle or referred from bony structures, as could occur as a result of prolonged or unphysiological postures resulting from weakness in muscles previously affected by polio. Because many post-polio patients complain of pain as well as fatigue, we propose that isometric testing is more appropriate, as efforts are less likely to be restricted by pain. Can be tested by the isometric mode of the Cybex machine, which can also measure isokinetic force, as we heard yesterday, and has proved valuable in investigating force-velocity relations of muscle and in providing certain forms of rehabilitation exercise. However, we feel that it offers no advantage in the present assessment of muscle weakness and fatigue over strain gauge dynamometry, which also allows electrical stimulation. Electrical studies can be used to differentiate central weakness or fatigue from peripheral fatigue. Fatigue is the failure to maintain a given force or power output during a sustained or repeated contraction, and is to be distinguished from a feeling of fatigue in the absence of any muscular activity. Central fatigue is due to a failure of neural drive and may be due to a lack of motivation or an impairment proximal to or involving recruitment of the motor neurons. Central fatigue can be demonstrated using the interpolation of twitches in the course of a voluntary contraction. The twitch interpolation technique involves superimposing electrical stimuli at 1 Hz during voluntary contractions of different strengths. Force is only increased by the twitches when voluntary contractions are submaximal. Central fatigue, which in our effort syndromes occurs in about 1/3 of patients, may be due to impairment of the ability to increase motor unit firing frequency, but clear evidence of this is yet to be demonstrated. However, failure to sustain firing frequency has been observed during contraction on patients with partially denervated muscle. This is compounded by more extensive loss of motor units than is appreciated from clinical examination. Another aspect of central fatigue is the perception of effort or voluntary contractions, which has been shown to be increased in patients with hemiplegia performing simple familiar motor tasks. Peripheral fatigue is due to failure within the periphery of the motor unit and is demonstrated by testing the contractile properties of the muscles during stimulated contractions. The frequency, force, and relation characteristics are examined by percutaneous supramaximal stimulation of motor nerves delivered in a set pattern of frequency. The force and EMG records produced are termed the program stimulation myogram. The quadriceps muscle is stimulated via the motor end nerves, and the adductor pollicis is stimulated via the ulnar nerve at the wrist. Fatigue can occur at high or low frequencies depending on the causal mechanism and the site of impairment. The next slide demonstrates the program stimulation myogram of adductor pollicis. The lower trace is the force record of contractions during stimulation at different frequencies of 1, 10, 20, 50, and 100 Hz. The upper trace is the differential force signal, which is used to calculate the maximal relaxation rate. Immediately after stimulation, force is reduced at all frequencies, but with recovery returns to normal. However, the force at low frequency, 10 and 20 hertz, takes longer to return to normal, and thus 10 to 50 and 20 to 50 hertz ratios may be used to assess fatigue. It is possible that previously damaged motor neurons are more susceptible to cell death with increasing age, so that weak muscles are working closer to their maximum force and metabolic limits, and so are closer to the point where fatigue occurs. This reduces the endurance capacity of the muscle to produce force, partly due to impeding the oxygen transport because of local restriction of the microcirculation. I'd like to conclude with a few thoughts on management, based on the positive, physiologically based policy which we use for other effort syndromes. At the last post-polio conference, Owen reported that active post-polio wheelchair athletes do not appear to complain of the symptoms of the post-polio syndrome, suggesting perhaps that previously high levels of individual exercise may be protective, possibly by one of the mechanisms listed on the next slide. Cardiovascular fitness should therefore be improved by a supervised endurance training program and monitored by exercise testing. And those who have become severely deconditioned, symptoms may be initially exacerbated by the exercise with resultant anxiety. Assessment of the psychological profile is important since it may reveal factors which can contribute to or perpetuate fatigue, as shown on the next slide. In addition to the stress of mental tasks and inactivity in type A achievers, adrenaline is increased by moderate to severe exercise, hypoglycemia, and cigarette smoking. Because it is Sunday sermon day, and because I have 1 minute left, I'd like to share my concept of the post-polio syndrome, which is that the fatigue, weakness, and pain may be due to energy imbalance, with functional impairment rather than the structural abnormality being the prime cause. Reduced phosphate energy stores, such as ATP, will result not only in fatigue in the nerve as well as the muscle, but also in reflex muscle spasm, muscle fibre damage, and lymphocyte accumulation. It is also important to control the weight to minimise gravitational stresses on weak muscles and therefore reduce fatigue and risk of damage. In this presentation, I've outlined the measures used in the Department of Medicine at the University of Liverpool by Professor Edwards to categorise the source of weakness and fatigue in patients presenting with effort syndromes. We would suggest that a similar approach in patients presenting with a post-polio syndrome may allow the relative contributions of central and peripheral fatigue to be determined and provide the basis of a physiologically based management program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Carr. We now have exactly 8 minutes for discussion. We'll treat, Laura and I have talked about it, we'll treat each talk with discussion as a block of 20 minutes. So if talk could go a little over, we'll be a little restrictive on the discussion.
Dallakis, NIH, Peter, I enjoy very much your approach, comprehensive and scientific approach to fatigue syndrome, which is really very crucial. I want to make a general comment on the needle biopsy. More, this actually is addressed to the speakers yesterday. A needle biopsy is not the right way to do biopsy in post-polio patients. The specimen is very small to count groups. As I pointed out yesterday, the groups in post-polio muscles are so large, up to 130 or 170 muscle fibers per group, that if you take a small specimen, you can really miss a lot of things. I was hoping Dr. Bradley will raise this issue yesterday in the discussion. So I really think it's wrong, very, very wrong, to do needle biopsy in post-polio patients. We have to do open muscle biopsies.
Would you accept, though, that repeated or multiple samples of needle muscle biopsy might be more acceptable to the patient, particularly if one wants to do sequential studies?
Well, it will be an easy way to do it, but I'm not sure if we'll really get you can get different units, even if you do, you cannot really go to the close to the next one. So multiple specimens, I'm not sure if it will be the answer. It's easier for all of us to do needle biopsies. I mean, this is the way to go if we want to do sequential studies. But for grouping, It's the problem.
Munsat, Boston, I'd like to extend that concept even further. If you do multiple biopsies in the vastus lateralis of a normal human at the same depth, a centimeter apart, there's as much as a 60% variance within a few centimeters in fiber-type composition, so that the sampling error in normals, let alone pathologic muscle, is so tremendous that one has to be very, very cautious about one biopsy or even two biopsies in the interpretation.
Joeed, Philadelphia. Dr. Gao, I wanted to find out about the mechanism of fatigue in different types of muscle fibers you have, one. Two, in polio patients, there is three types of fibers you would have. One are intact fibers, which are supposedly overworked, which are newly re-innervated, and the second type of fibers you have, newly re-innervated fibers, and maybe functional, and some of them might be re-innervated but non-functional. Is there any way to distinguish between the fatigue of these three types of fibers? You know, that's one of the big problems, I think, when you are evaluating fatigue in an enlarged motor unit.
Yes, I'm not too sure that I can answer the first. I think that what would need to be done is studies using this program stimulation myogram in quadriceps muscles that we know have either got a predominance of type 1 fibers, such as in a marathon athlete, or in those that have got predominance of type 2. I also think similarly that until we actually do the studies on patients with polio and in some way try to correlate with the biopsy appearances, but again it may not be a representative sample of the muscle.
Well, that's what I'm trying to refer to, the one frequency. Would one frequency be able to evaluate fatigue in three subtypes or populations of muscle fibers?
See, I think all that we can do is look at whether it's low frequency fatigue, which is the fatigue that lasts for longer in the muscle, or whether it's a high frequency fatigue, which is not physiological. And I think that the importance in these effort syndromes, and something which hasn't been addressed either in Liverpool or really at this conference, is the recovery time after someone is fatigued before the person can again make an effort. Because one could postulate that if one makes an effort before the muscle and the nerve has been allowed to recover, that this will just compound and amplify the fatigue which occurs.
So we'll proceed with Dr. Augusta Alba from the Goldwater Memorial Hospital.
Bring this over to the side since I usually talk from the slides. Let me see if we... At Goldwater Hospital, we've had a work physiology laboratory for more than 20 years, and for more than 6 years, we've actively tested and trained our inpatient rehabilitation patients with all kinds of neuromuscular disease, so it was natural just to add the polios to this group. Within the past year, I decided to take out their information and see whether I could find anything from it which would be of value for us who are working in the field. This simply represents our population. Like many of the other populations reported here today, it's a self-referred group. As you can see, our average age was about 49. About two-thirds of the patient had the onset of polio under the age of 10. The years in which they were tested were about 39 years post-polio. Symptoms had started about, on the average, 36 years post-polio. Of the group, 33 out of 35 had new symptoms. Two came because of curiosity and fear, because of the publicity around this problem. I searched my mind as to how to put them into various groups, and the simplest thing for me as a physiatrist was to decide to do it according to function. And we broke them down into group 1, 2, and 3, those who were, as you can see, walking without any restriction or moderate restriction and so forth. I had some difficulties, some I shifted back and forth in a couple of groups here, but I finally decided that if you could walk around your house and maybe you could walk about a block, I put you in group 2. And group 3, if you stood up to transfer to the bed or wheelchair and maybe made a couple of steps in the effort, I didn't consider that even a severe restriction. I considered you wheelchair bound. There were people in group 2, obviously, who because of their restriction were already using scooters or motorized wheelchairs in addition to walking. As a result, we had about 17, we did have 17 in group 1, and we had 18 in groups 2 and 3, and slightly less men than women. I did look at their weights. For the most part, they were well within a wide range of normal body weights. I didn't look at their frames, so I took the broad range of body weights for small, medium, and large frames. And there are only 2 patients I'd like to point out. Here's one lady who is 40% above her, the maximum ideal body weight for a large frame. And here's one man who is 49% below the minimum body weight for his age, ignoring his scoliosis. So this young man was, nothing more than practically skin and bones. I included a comment on the scoliosis simply because in doing work on the ergometer, there were at least 2 patients who complained of pain in their back in areas of scoliosis, and we found that moderately severe scoliosis in the females was about 40%, and the men was about 27%. Now, here were the vital capacities. It's interesting to note that in all groups, you had people as low as, below 50% of vital capacity. And in the first 2 groups, you had people that were close to 100%, but in the third group, who were wheelchair-bound, I had no one with a VC above 74%. In all groups, we had people who were using ventilators nights. This may be more than the average population, which is seen simply because we have the Respiratory Rehabilitation Center there. And let me see if this... Can that be focused a bit better? There we are. So we had 2 in this group, 4 here and 2 here. All of these patients had vital capacities below 50%, and everyone with a vital capacity below 50%, except one with a VC of 48%, who was a non-smoker, used a ventilator either nights and sometime during the day. There was only one patient, the one who was 49% below ideal body weight, who actually used his ventilator when he did his exercises with his legs. Again, this is out of focus. What I was surprised to find that I found a mild to moderate, and in 3 cases here, a severe pattern of obstructive pulmonary pattern on the 4th vital capacity, which I didn't expect. I put the smokers down here in the group. We have a number of smokers. The 2 here who weren't smoking, who had a severe pattern of obstructive pulmonary problem, both had been heavy smokers before. Of the group, 5 out of 13 who had the obstructive pattern were smoking, which is 40%. Of the whole group, 7 out of 34 smoke, which was 21%. An obstructed pattern showed up in 38% of patients. That means you have a combined problem, not only one of a restrictive lung disease from your polio and scoliosis, but also one from actual airway involvement. Then we went on to find the resting VO2s of this group. One would anticipate, since resting VO2 is dependent on your lean body weight, that they would have values less than normal. And this is what was found. This was the average value for the resting VO2, and that's in mils per kilogram per minute. And these were the ranges. You see, we had people down here to 1.7 mils per kilo per minute. I put them all together since the men and women were essentially the same. And I put a value down here of 3.5, which is the value for VO2, which is used in calculating METs. And that is standard in the equipment that is available today. And a MET can be calculated either with the individual's own VO2 or with the standard. And you see that if you use their own resting values, you're going to have higher MET values for the most part, except for this person, than you would normally. Here's their percent heart rate max, which is one way of looking at how much they can accomplish. And you see there's a whole group who couldn't get much higher than 60%, but on the whole, the average was considerably higher. These are values you can actually use for training people. We do train as low as 60, 65% as well. Another way of looking at energy expenditure is double product. And you see that for the most part, the highest they were able to attain was 2.3. The average population can go up to 3 to 5 times resting. The Goldwater population, which is a long-term care hospital with a rehab inpatient population, is 1.5 to 2 times resting. So our group fell within this group, maybe a bit higher. Here's VO2 max for the average population. I just want to make a comment that normals are divided into low, average, and high VO2 max. And females are different from men, and it drops with the decade. So you see the tremendous drop, which is greater for the low average than it is for the high average, and is greater for women than it is for men. So you have to take this into consideration when you make your calculations. I simply threw up here a slide which says that if you have a VO2 max, say, of less than 15, you're in a severe class of respiratory impairment, but this is normal for men of 60 to 69. There would be moderately severe if you didn't know this particular fact. This simply shows the same thing for women. Here's a normal woman, 60 to 69, with 13 as a low normal. She would be classified as class 4 if you didn't take this into consideration. These were simply our results on the hand ergometer. You sent small muscles produce less oxygen max than large muscles. And the values in the literature are for your legs. And since the maximum value is about 100 watts on a hand ergometer and about 300 on a chair ergometer, I simply took 1/3 as the VO2 max for the upper extremities. And then I compared all of our patients, and here's where they were. This is the time they were able to average, which was about 6 minutes, and the watts is somewhat lower in the third group. Here's their VO2 max on the treadmill, which was considerably worse. Most of them fell under a low normal response in both groups. Of course, the third group couldn't cycle. Here's their time on the treadmill and the chair, and for the second group, it was considerably less. And these were the limiting factors. And as you can see, everybody except two complained of fatigue. And the one who didn't have fatigue had extreme lower extremity discomfort first. And these are the other factors that were involved. And here's the anaerobic threshold, which is frequently used as a non-invasive means of determining whether someone has reached a lactic acidemia. And you can see here it is they reached this level sooner than they did on the hand ergometer than they did on the treadmill or the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Alba, for this very, very interesting talk. Open for discussion.
Yes. Johnson, Columbus, Ohio. How did you get the predicted or ideal weights for these people? Because most individuals who have lost a substantial amount of muscle are not appropriately taken from the table.
I realize that. I use the table. And with the full understanding that if you're going to have muscle atrophy of a varying degree, that you're going to fall below. But it's amazing that more people didn't fall below than did.
Well, I was just making the point that you
absolutely
have to, yeah, right, and you have to estimate the degree of muscle loss and then subtract that from the,
right.
Okay.
Perry, California. I didn't understand how you did your hand ergometer test. Would you describe it a little bit now that you have a little more time?
We have a Monarch arm ergometer, and you simply have them cycle that as you would cycle the chair ergometer.
Is this maximum effort or a fixed resistance?
The instrument is calibrated in watts, and we either did it as a continuous test if we thought they had enough muscle strength, or we did it as an interval test in which the observer or the tester can increase the wattage as the patient's going along, and you keep increasing it to the point where you think that they can't handle it anymore. And the values that you found on that particular table were the maximum that they could handle.
You calculated a watt time total, is that kind of thing?
I hadn't done that. Although we had the time, but the wattage varied as they went up in testing.
Gunnar Grimby, Göteborg, Sweden. Fatigue can be sensed in different ways. Did you try to separate that? I can think of two ways. One, with rating of perceived exertion or perceived breathlessness or perceived fatigue in different muscle groups. And I'm especially interested if you could get some indication of a respiratory muscle fatigue. Or did you monitor the ventilation and could get evidence of either hypoventilation or that the ventilatory pattern changed with, for example, recordings of chest wall movements indicating respiratory muscle fatigue as being a cause for stopping the exercise?
We had at least one or two patients in the group who in addition to generalized fatigue, complained of shortness of breath. No one observed their actual pattern of breathing during the testing.
Thank you very much. We are really not running out of time at the moment. Don't be afraid of discussing because of the authoritarian attitude Laura Halstead and I had in the beginning. I'll just say that. The next speaker is Dr. Jacqueline Perry from Rancho, which is in California.
Good morning. Let me first express my thanks to be included in this conference. It's been excellent, and I appreciate being part of it. Secondly, in order to allow some comparisons, I've arranged for two carousels or two projectors, and I want to thank Bill for taking advantage and giving me that opportunity. The purpose of this presentation, or this study, actually is to find out how patients are using their muscles. We studied the weight-bearing muscles, three at the hip, the vast lateralis for the quadriceps, the soleus and the gastric medius at the ankle, and we used fine wire, 50 micron wires using Basmagian technique of two wires per month in one needle. We tested people walking free and fast. We have a 10-meter walkway. In the middle, 6 meters is marked for data. And then we also did manual muscle testing and quantitative testing. I'm not going to talk about the latter. We recorded the swing and stance by foot switches, which you can see is barely taped to the bottom of the sole. They record heel, first and fifth metatarsal, and great toe. We quantitated the EMG by rectifying it and sampling the amplitudes at 2,500 samples a second, and then relating it on a relative scale as a percentage of the maximum muscle test for each activity, and thus all our data are recorded as percent of a maximum muscle test. In addition, recognizing the fragility of a manual muscle test, we also used Beasley's scale and put it in numbers and corrected our muscle test, or at least a maximum muscle test, by this score of recognizing that grade 4 or good is approximately 40%, and we calculated the others from his standard. Whoops, went the wrong way, pardon me. As a result, each chart you'll see will have two pieces of data on it. The yellow lines will be our quantitative muscle EMG, which is percent of maximum muscle test, which is this scale. And then the red will be the what we're calling a normal equivalent with the corrected Beasley factor. On that base, we had 19 subjects, and all of who have been post-polio for several years. They fell into four groups. We have three controls in that we two patients. The first two came just to ask if they should worry. They're not having complaints at this time, but are active people. And you can see they had considerable weakness. This man actually had no muscle. He had a perfect contracture, which gave him an ideal ankle control. And the third man really had an arm problem, but was also and had no leg complaints. The so-called strong, as you can see, they're all in the roughly four. These are sort of evenly involved, and by a manual muscle test and by my res interpretation, they had no problems because they could take considerable resistance, but they were all symptomatic. This group were non-symptomatic. And then we had another group with weak calf, but grade 3s and 4 quads, and another group, just two of them, with a weak quadriceps. And so these are the four groups we divided them into. The walking capacities of all four groups averaged about the same, interesting enough, at free walking, but you can see that their fast walking was considerably limited. This fast walking data should be 128 meters a minute. Now, in order to make comparisons, on this particular series of comparisons, the slide on your left will be the controls and or the normal, not normal, but the asymptomatic group, and the other group will be the so-called strong. The control group shows a normal pattern on the gluteus maximus, and that is, this is pre-swing in which they are decelerating the limb and setting it towards extension, and this would be the loading response at the beginning of the cycle, where they're, of course, stabilizing the limb for weight-bearing. The timing is appropriate. The amplitudes are a little high. And the normal equivalent is just about right of about 10 to 15%. In the semimembranosus membranosus, they have a much higher and more vigorous deceleration. This is the normal function of that muscle, and it's working a little harder. I forgot to compare the other group. Now I've really done it. Which they say you should never... There we go. What you can see in the symptomatic group... Did I get the right muscle? There we go. Well, I want to go back forward, but both of them... I'm going to go back this way, one, because I want to see both of these people. If I go back this way, you can see in gluteus maximus, there's nothing happening in mid-swing, mid-stance, whereas the gluteus maximus of the symptomatic strong group were overusing their muscle. And then if we go on to semimembranosus, you can see the same thing again. They have a premature activity, high activity, and prolonged, at least another phase of activity. So again, they're overusing those muscles, even though presumed they had adequate strength. And then in the gastric nemius for the control group, it's a little premature. It should start about there. The height is not bad, it's a little high. And again, in the symptomatic group, you have it more premature and higher. And then the interesting one contrast is in the quadriceps. For some unknown reason, our strong group didn't bother to use their quadriceps. They used everything else but. And the control group did have a small amount of quadriceps once in a while, but this magnitude would be under the fatigue level. Then the second group I want to compare, these are the people with the weak calf, and these are the people with the weak quadriceps, and they showed an interesting pattern. With the weak calf, which is supposed to catch the tibia and stabilize the knee from about this point on, you can see that the people substitute their quadriceps with prolonged activity, and slightly premature activity to preset it. The people with the... and then you can see on the basis of that, they have practically no effectiveness in their weak calf, but they were using it like mad, and so these people were using a very weak muscle group excessively, as well as using their other muscles excessively, and both of these would be the people with the weak calf. Then you take the people with the weak quadriceps, and this poor little trace quadriceps is working like mad, accomplishing nothing, but working very madly, and they're using their calf muscles very prematurely and very high. And then this particular one is a shows the control group when they walked fast. And you can see that their neat little efficiency is gone. And as soon as they got out of their spontaneous gait, they started using their cordyceps madly all the time, very high amplitudes, and the gastrocnemius went up very high, and so that suddenly their efficiency is no longer available. And the clinical recommendation would be that these people make every effort in the world not to hurry, that they stay in their self-set, and that's exactly the kind of recommendation I made to these people, that we had three people who could be efficient if they stayed in their set mode, but not to to rush. Thus, if you want to summarize, you can say the asymptomatic group had high intensity but very short duration, and thus were not, on that basis, not threatened. On the other hand, the symptomatic group as a whole had high intensity plus prolonged duration and therefore had overuse of their muscles. This relates to two pieces of muscle physiology that's in the literature, and one is the fatigue tolerance of intermittent activity, and what you can see that a person can work hard, even 76% of maximum, if they keep the duration very brief. On the other hand, if a person is going to have prolonged activity, the intensity must be below 16%. And so we had our control group essentially in this population, and we had our symptomatic group in here someplace with both too much intensity and too much duration. This we can extrapolate further from phosphocreatinine creatinine studies in which with normal people, athletes, doing exhaustive exercise, they markedly reduced their phosphocreatine. They got 90% recovery in 2 minutes, but it took them 20 minutes to get full recovery. And so we could think in terms of our polios that they keep staying in this semi-deficit basis if they don't have sufficient rest in between the cycles of muscle function. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Perry. I think I'll open the discussion by asking you, well, first stating from my point of view that it was so beautiful to see that Beasley is still not forgotten. He shouldn't be. However, I think it's necessary to think what the real meaning of the scale is when you have a 4+ or a 3 or whatever. However, do you use it for didactic purposes, your ratio? Or do you feel there is any... I can't see that you increase reproducibility or validity. Is there any specific reason for using it except for the didactics?
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.